Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Burundi's embattled president has officially delayed the presidential election after weeks of protests sparked by his decision to run for a third term. President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree Wednesday that moves the presidential vote from June 26th to July 15th. It also revises the dates for the National Assembly and Senate elections. East African leaders and the United Nations had pushed the president to delay the elections in hopes of curbing weeks of violent political protests. The protests began after Nkurunziza said he will run for a third term as president. A suicide bomber blew himself up Wednesday outside the ancient Karnak Temple in southern Egypt in an attack that left four people wounded. Officials said that attack involved two other people who were killed by police and that none of the wounded were tourists. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The temple in the city of Luxor is part of a UNESCO World Heritage Site on the banks of the Nile River that is a major tourist attraction for both foreign and Egyptian tourists. The European Commission said Wednesday that it's not satisfied with Athens' latest reform proposal, as the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras was scheduled to meet in Brussels with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Francois Hollande to discuss new bailout funds for the country. Greece has 3 weeks to come up with the cash to avoid a default on its obligations to the International Monetary Fund when its international package expires at the end of June. The European Commission said Wednesday that the new Greek proposals do not reflect early discussions. VOA News. The United States appeared set Wednesday to send about 400 additional military trainers to Iraq in a new effort to bolster Iraqi troops as they try to retake Ramadi. That's the Anbar provincial capital that was seized last month by Islamic State insurgents. The extra trainers would augment the 3,100 that U.S. already has in Iraq. But U.S. President Barack Obama has continued to rule out sending ground troops back into Iraq after withdrawing them in 2011. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Tuesday said there's an urgent need to accelerate training.
Iraqi security forces that have benefited from the support of our coalition military partners have performed well on the battlefield. And what we know is that in at least one recent area where we experienced a setback in Ramadi, those were forces that had not benefited from being trained by the U.S.-led coalition.
The U.S. will reportedly open a new training site at Al-Taqdim, which is a desert air base that once served as an American military hub. A White House announcement on the matter is expected this afternoon. FIFA says it suspended the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup because of the ongoing corruption scandal involving the World Football Governing Body. It would be nonsense to start the bidding in any process for the time being, according to the FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valky at a news conference in Russia on Wednesday. The host of the 2026 World Football Championship was set to be chosen by FIFA members during a 2017 meeting in Malaysia. However, it's not clear when the decision will be made. A U.S. indictment issued last month charges 9 FIFA officials and 5 corporate executives with offenses that include racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. The Secretary General of FIFA, Jerome Valky, responded to that.
Nothing was big enough during the process to say that the final decision was in line with all the rules and regulations which have been in place. And in fact, it's the same conclusion Michael Garcia had in this report.
Meanwhile, the United States, Canada, Mexico, and European countries are thought to be among the likely bidders for the tournament. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has begun to visit to China to bolster diplomatic ties that have been tested as a result of her country's democratic reforms. The China's Communist Party is hosting the Myanmar democracy icon. She's traveling with a delegation from the National League for Democracy. Officials expect Aung San Suu Kyi to meet with top Chinese leaders. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up at this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Burundi is delaying its presidential elections following protests against the president's bid for a third term in office. The move comes as regional bodies urge continued dialogue with the opposition to resolve the political crisis in the country.
That's VOA's Gabe Justlow reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the European Union is urging its 28 members to agree to a plan to share responsibility for resettling migrants. And in Nigeria, military officials have announced that Maiduguri International Airport will soon reopen.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algiers, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Burundi is delaying its presidential elections following protest against the president's bid for a third term in office. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the move comes as regional bodies urge continued dialogue with the opposition to resolve the political crisis in the country.
Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, issued a decree late Tuesday postponing the presidential vote to July 15th, about 2 weeks later than initially planned. Parliamentary elections have also been pushed back about a month and are now scheduled to be held June 29th. Presidential spokesman Gervais Abayeho told VOA the new timetable is designed to give the opposition time to organize for the vote.
Opposition parties were claiming that they didn't have enough time to campaign given the situation that was prevailing here, so that they can be given ample time to do so. That is the motivation behind that.
Opposition parties and civil society activists have led weeks of street protests against President Nkurunziza's plans to run for a third term in office, which opponents say would be against the law. Some opposition leaders rejected the new timetable for elections when it was first proposed by the country's Electoral Commission. A spokesman for an opposition coalition told VOA Daybreak Africa Tuesday the commission did not have the legal mandate to change the dates. The election delay is in line with recommendations put forward last month by East African heads of state. Meantime, the International Conference of the Great Lakes region has urged the government to continue a national dialogue with members of the opposition and civil society to find a way out of the current crisis. Ambeyi Ligabo is the director of the ICGLR Governance and Democracy Program.
We are optimistic that both parties can see sense in the need to have dialogue to avoid any violence and also disruption of economic and trade activities among member states of ICGLR.
The United Nations has raised concerns about an escalation in political violence around the polls. On Tuesday, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zaid Ra'ad Al Hussein, said the United Nations has been receiving deeply worrying accounts of executions, abductions, and other violent acts attributed to pro-government militia. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The European Union is urging its 28 members to agree to sharing responsibility for resettling migrants. Tens of thousands are expected over the next 2 years. Under the plan, migrants would be distributed across the EU according to each nation's unemployment rate, size, and economic output. That would mean most asylum seekers would be resettled in Germany, France, Italy, and Spain. Britain already has opted out. Hungary, Slovakia, and Estonia also have rejected the idea. Britain, Denmark, and Ireland have exemptions to agreements with the EU regarding asylum and border patrols. London wants the EU to do more to target smugglers in Libya who profit from transporting refugees. The UN say nearly 52,000 migrants have entered Europe this year, mostly by crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa. A large proportion arrived by boat in Italy and Greece. Nearly 50,000 have died trying to reach Europe.
In Nigeria, military officials have announced that Maiduguri International Airport will soon reopen. It was closed 2 years ago due to attacks by the rebel group Boko Haram. Maiduguri is the capital of Borno State in the northeastern part of the country. Air Marshal Adesola Amusu says the Nigerian Airport Management Authority had requested the airport be allowed to operate between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. He says the airport could be closed at any time if there's a security threat. President Buhari recently announced that Maiduguri is the new location for the Military Command and Control Center, aiding in the fight against Boko Haram. The center had been located in the country's capital, Abuja. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 11 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi is delaying its presidential elections following protests against the president's bid for a third term in office. The UN says nearly 52,000 migrants have entered Europe this year, mostly by crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa. And in Nigeria, military officials have announced that Maiduguri International Airport will soon reopen. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
It's estimated thousands of children in Ghana work in dangerous, unlicensed gold mines. A new report says they risk injury when mines collapse and are exposed to dust and mercury poisoning. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The 82-page Human Rights Watch report, Precious Metal, Cheap Labor, documents the use of child workers in Ghana's gold mines. These mines are often small-scale or subsistence mines, known as artisanal or unlicensed gold mines. HRW senior researcher Julianne Kippenberg spoke about the findings from Accra.
This has been going on for a long time because artisanal and small-scale gold mining is a very long-standing and old practice in Ghana, but also in other parts of West Africa. Child labor in this sector is something that's also been going on for a very long time. According to a recent survey by the government, around 7,400 children are working in mining.
The gold mines are often shallow pits that can collapse, causing injury or death.
We also found that many children do the processing of the ore with mercury. And mercury is a toxic metal. It's liquid and it's used to attract the gold particles in the ore. It's very practical for that, but it's also highly poisonous and particularly dangerous for children whose bodies are still developing. We met one guy who was actually carrying around with him a small bottle of mercury that he was sort of carrying in his trousers.
Mercury poisoning has many symptoms. They include tremors, vomiting, hearing loss, psychiatric problems, chest pain, paralysis, headaches, seizures, and death. Mercury is openly sold in many shops in Ghana's mining areas.
There are other problems too. Some boys carry extremely heavy loads, and this causes really strong pain for them, but also can obviously lead to long-term spinal damage.
And then there's the dust.
Some of the children that we interviewed complained about coughs and other respiratory problems and that they were spitting out blood.
Kippenberg says many children want to work in the mines because they receive some payment or some gold in return. But she says they're often unaware of the risks. Ghana has many different mining areas, but Human Rights Watch has been conducting its research in the Western, Central, and Ashanti regions since 2013. Overall, Kippenberg says, gold mining employs between 500,000 and 1 million people. Last year, the industry produced about 40 tons of gold worth more than $1.7 billion. The gold travels a long supply chain, from local traders to exporters and then on to the global market. Switzerland, South Africa, the United Arab Emirates, and India are some of the major destinations.
You have many, many different sort of local traders and some exporters who then sell on to an even smaller number of global refiners. There are only about 20 or so international refiners of importance that refine pretty much all the gold there is in the world. So these refiners hold a very important position in that supply chain. And from there onwards, they then sell on to jewelry, banks, electronics industry, and so on.
The Human Rights Watch researcher says some refiners and exporters do attempt to adhere to Ghanaian and international law regarding child labor. Nevertheless, she says, they often do not have full control over the supply chain and may not know the origin of the gold. Kippenberg says Ghana's government has taken some action to deal with the problem.
First of all, child labor in mining is actually prohibited by law, and that's quite a good and strong law. The government also has a sector that is formalized. So there are about 1,300 or so holders of licenses that actually have formalized mine licenses. So this is very important because it means that these holders of licenses have to abide by certain rules, including no use of child labor, and they will be inspected by the government for that.
However, she says, the vast majority of the artisanal gold mines are not licensed.
There, child labor is occurring. There are no inspections, no interventions. It's just taking place.
Human Rights Watch is calling for greater government oversight of Ghana's gold mining and the use of alternatives to mercury in gold processing.
In 2013, governments came together and adopted the UN Minamata Convention on Mercury to protect internationally people from the threat of that pollutant. And the government of Ghana has signed that convention but hasn't ratified it. And we believe it's really necessary that Ghana ratifies and implements that convention.
Kippenberg also says the government-owned Precious Minerals Marketing Corporation, or PMMC, should require gold traders to follow human rights law when issuing them licenses. The government, she says, should also ensure that education and food programs reach children in gold mining areas. Human Rights Watch calls on the Ghanaian government to lead the way in Africa by developing a comprehensive strategy for safe, professional, and child labor-free gold mining. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new report says human trafficking and child labor is on the decline in Cameroon after the government enacted tough laws and began vigorously prosecuting offenders. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more on the story from Yaoundé.
I know that I can make it. I know that I can stand. No matter what, make all my way.
Nadesh Nge, 28 years old, sings to praise the network of Cameroon Women, an association created 25 years ago to press for strong legislation on forced labor and sex trafficking. Nadesh was only 8 years old when she was forced into working as a servant in the home of an influential state functionary in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Her family had been promised $20 a month. She eventually escaped and was taken in and trained by the network of Cameroon Women. Today, she is a lawyer committed to defending the rights of women who are going through what she experienced.
For the younger generation, I would say, especially to young women, do not let society dictate who you should be. Be yourself, and it's only then that we can be able to change the world, because if we don't begin with us, where are we going?
The network of Cameroon Women has issued a report showing a drop in the number of cases of women and children forced into labor and the sex trade. The report notes that the network had 275 cases in 1990, and today it is handling 150 cases. The group notes its biggest challenge is trying to track the young women sent to Europe by sex traffickers. Justice Prudence Galiga, technical advisor to Cameroon's Minister of the Environment, says she thinks the biggest factor is the drop came about once women felt they could report cases of abuse and violence. She credits the 1995 Beijing World Conference on Women, in which delegates left determined to work for greater equality and opportunities through legislation to eliminate discriminatory practices.
Beijing had raised awareness that women could effectively be agents of change in their communities if they created the space to make their voices heard.
She says the Beijing Declaration cleared the way for women in Cameroon to press for changes in laws when it came to prosecuting abusers and child traffickers. She says the case-building process has been streamlined and the arduous requirements for children to prove abuse have been amended. Now, says Justice Galiga, there are more cases successfully prosecuted, even cases involving senior government officials.
You will agree with me today that it's not easy for you to get a little girl of 8 or 7 years and to pay her 5,000 francs or 10,000 a month to take care of your children. Gone are those days when that could happen, because was able to get into parliament with victims to advocate the first law that was adopted in this country to convict traffickers in children.
But advocates note there is still a long way to go. According to Global Giving, a U.S.-based charity dedicated to grassroots projects, 2.4 million Cameroonian children still illegally work mostly in the homes of the rich to help support their families. Are Merlin, who runs a center to provide psychological care of victims, says it is so easy to deceive children and young women with promises of a better life.
When they take someone, there is an agreement. Either maybe you register for work as a tailor or a hairdresser, or you go to school. And most of the time, they end up just being in the house. At times, they're beaten very brutally. At times, hot objects like irons are used on them. They give them sour food to eat. You not treat a fellow human being like an animal. Even dogs are not to be treated that way.
Justice Galiga says the women of Cameroon are working hard to address these remaining challenges.
Today we have task forces made up of judges, made up of civil society organizations to see how they could combat this phenomenon out of our society. That is an example of what women can do and women have begun doing. We want to invite the men to join, and I think we would make a significant impact.
Cameroon's 2011 anti-trafficking law mandates sentences of up to 20 years when the trafficking victim is 15 years or younger. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
23 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, public outcry and parliament have forced Malawian President Peter Mutharika to suspend the sale of a state-owned bank, which has been weighed down by bad loans. Lamek Masina reports from Johannesburg.
The attempted sale of the Malawi Savings Bank was in response to advice from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund after banking experts said the MSB failed to meet the minimum liquidity requirements. The institutions also said they observed that the politically connected persons got huge loans from the MSB but were failing to pay them, a move they said was compromising the bank's operation. This forced Malawi officials to look for investors to buy controlling stakes in the bank. The privately-owned FDH Financial Holdings Limited became the only bidder, offering about $12 million for the purchase of the 75% of the bank's shares, a move which parliamentarians described as an epic swindle. Ryan OGP was the chairperson for the Parliament's Budget and Finance Committee.
The committee's stand was the process of selling this bank hasn't been good, and the bidding process didn't actually have a lot of bidders in it. We really wanted the process to be started again.
The parliamentarians also argued that with over 70 branches countrywide, MSB was the only bank which covered most rural areas where over 80% of Malawians live. They said selling it would deprive these Malawians of banking services. Civil society groups have pushed for the bank to be recapitalized instead of being sold. In May, they had protests after the government announced that it would pay off $13 million owed to the bank by private sector players, the vast majority of whom were the ruling party's politicians. In a petition to parliament, the group said they would not allow taxpayers' money to be used to pay off loans for greedy politicians and businessmen. They threatened to hold vigils at parliament and all MSB branches nationwide unless the government complied with their demand. Jared Viola's President Mutharika's spokesperson, he told VOA the suspension of the bank sale is not a response to any pressure.
The president has not been defeated. If anything, it is democracy which is at stake here. Look, we have a president who is listening to those that are against and those that are for and come up with a binding solution.
Viola also said the government has established a debt collection unit to ensure those who borrowed the money from the MSB pay back their loans. Parliamentarian Jessica Bwira is the spokesperson of the leading opposition party in parliament, the Malawi Congress Party. She says the party is treating the suspension with a touch of skepticism.
We welcome the suspension. We are just want to be cautious that this should not be a way to just buy time so that the budget is passed and then we see the issue come back again. So for us, we would have been happier with a cancellation of this whole thing, because that one would totally have been in tandem with what Malawians are trying to say.
Economists have warned that the uncertainty surrounding the bank could cause customers to withdraw their deposits, a situation that would make the bank's financial position even worse. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The older a person gets, the more medical conditions that person often has. In fact, a new global analysis of ill health and disability found that the average older adult suffered from at least five non-life-threatening health ailments in 2013. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
More than 95% of the world's population has health problems. That's according to a detailed report called the Global Burden of Disease Study. It found that one-third of the world, or 2.3 billion people, live with multiple health ailments, many of which contribute to disability but not death. Teo Voss, a professor of global health at the University of Washington's Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, led the study. Voss says the most common causes of disability were largely age-related.
Across the world, the two largest components are the musculoskeletal problems, with low back pain, neck pain, and arthritis being very dominant, and then the mental disorders, where depression and anxiety are the biggest one contributing to the amounts of disability.
Also prominent as causes of disability in older age were iron deficiency, anemia, drug and alcohol abuse, hearing loss, and dental problems. The study, published in the journal The Lancet, analyzed more than 35,000 pieces of information on disease and injury from 188 countries between 1990 and 2013. In sub-Saharan Africa, complications related to HIV/AIDS were a key driver of disability in recent times. Voss says Asian countries had the least amount of disability.
So China, Japan, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, they have relatively lower rates of disability. And whether that is due to more prudent lifestyles in terms of diet, less obesity, that is not so clear.
Given their toll on healthcare systems and quality of life, Voss says preventable causes of poor health have not received the societal attention they deserve. Voss says it's important not only to keep people alive into old age, but for them to remain healthy. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van.
host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi delays its presidential elections following protest against the president's bid for a third term in office. The European Union is urging its 28 members to agree to a plan to share responsibility for resettling migrants. And in Nigeria, military officials have announced that Maiduguri International Airport will soon reopen. Coming up, we'll have music from Algeria, and in our feature segment, the third part of a series on Johannesburg. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand today you are tipping off with pro basketball.
Kim, the Cleveland Cavaliers defeated the visiting Golden State Warriors 96-91 to take a 2-1 lead in the National Basketball Association Finals. The Cavaliers were again led by superstar LeBron James, who scored 40 points, grabbed 12 rebounds, and passed for 8 assists. LeBron has scored 123 points during this championship series, the most ever for the first 3 games of the NBA Finals. LeBron says he and the Cavs were fired up by the sellout crowd of 20,562 at Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland.
They were unbelievable from the start to the finish. And, you know, we fed off them. And we just tried to give it all back to them for 48 minutes. As loud as they need to go home now and start soaking up a lot of tea, drinking a lot of tea for the next 36 hours, whatever the case may be, because they need to be just as loud Thursday night. So I need you guys to get those voices right. But they're going to be unbelievable Thursday night as well. Those guys, everyone, they're amazing.
Meanwhile, Warriors star Stephen Curry, the league's most valuable player, was not amazing for much of Game 3, but he came alive during the fourth quarter when he scored 17 points, almost helping the Warriors rally from a 20-point second-half deficit. Hey, Steph, what changed in the fourth quarter?
We became the aggressors, just like the last 2 minutes of Game 2. For us to win this series, we have to play that way the whole game. We have the depth, we have the talent to do it, whether we're at home or on the road. So no excuse why, you know, for 3 quarters we were kind of, I think we were playing hard and we were into it, but there are no results to show for it and you can't really, you know, get any spark. So especially on the road, we have to play free, have fun, and be the aggressors if we're going to win this series.
If Steph Curry and the Warriors are going to win this best-of-seven game series, they'll also have to slow down Cleveland's Australian guard, Matthew Dellavedova, who has frustrated Curry with his pressure defense. Dellavedova also delivered offensively in Game 3, scoring 20 points and earning praise from LeBron James.
Well, I know one thing I'm going to count on Deli as always is how hard he's going to play. He's going to give everything he got, his body. He's going to throw his body all over the place, and he's going to compete at a high level for how many minutes he's out on the floor. Tonight it was 38 and a half minutes, and for 38 and a half minutes he gave everything he got. And you know, it was great to have someone like that out on the floor that's willing to sacrifice everything for the better of the team.
Cleveland Cavaliers basketball star LeBron James. LeBron and the Cavs will host the Golden State Warriors Thursday night in Game 4 of the NBA Finals. Cleveland leads the championship series 2-1. It's a safe bet that LeBron will one day be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Let's take a short break now for this important message from a Congolese giant who will be enshrined in the Hall of Fame on September 11th.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Today, Wednesday, is a rest day for the 24 teams competing at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. Players will take the field again on Thursday when four games take place, including a clash between Ivory Coast and Thailand. Tuesday's action saw four close games as France beat England 1-0, while Colombia and Mexico settled for a one-all draw, allowing the French to grab first place in Group F. A 2-0 win over South Korea put Brazil at the top of Group E early in this tournament, and Spain and Costa Rica each picked up a point as they drew 1-1. Meanwhile, in New Zealand Wednesday, the first knockout stage matches were played at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup for men. A matchup of West African nations pitted Ghana against Mali for the right to advance to the quarterfinals. A great performance and goal by Malian keeper Jigi Jara and three wonder strikes from Jadie Samaseku, Dudone Bakle, and Abubakar Doumbia sealed an impressive 3-0 win for Mali. The Malian boys will now face a tough quarterfinal matchup against either Germany or Nigeria. Another West African team was also in action Wednesday as Senegal took on Ukraine in the round of 16. A very close-fought game ended in a one-all draw after second-half goals by Ukraine's Artem Besedyan and Senegal's Sidi Sarr. So they had to go to a penalty kick shootout, and the Senegalese prevailed. Senegalese keeper Ibusi was more than ready. He saved Ukraine's first two attempts, while Senegal made their first three. Ukraine scored on their third try, but he dived in front of the fourth attempt by Artem Lukevich to give Senegal the win in the penalty kick shootout. So the Senegalese boys will now play the winner of Austria-Uzbekistan on Sunday. The United States, meanwhile, fought through a late red card to defeat Colombia 1-0 behind a great goal from Rubio Ruben. U.S. keeper Zachary Steffen also made a crucial penalty save in the 83rd minute to keep the Americans in the lead. Serbia pulled off one of the most unlikely wins of the tournament so far against Hungary. A stoppage time equalizer from Serbian Ivan Saponjic forced extra time. The Serbians would then go down to 10 men in extra time due to a red card, but they managed to win the game when a cross deflected off the foot of Hungarian defender Attila Talibor and into the net for an own goal. That sets up a quarterfinal matchup between Serbia and the USA as both teams seek to reach the semifinals of the tournament for the first time since the 1980s. Looking ahead to Thursday, well, the premier matchup pits European champion Germany against African champion Nigeria in the round of 16 in Christchurch, New Zealand. The winner will play Mali on Sunday, also in Christchurch.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Kikwete.
United, we can beat malaria.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C. D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. President Obama, like his counterpart in Tanzania, President Kikwete, is a big sports fan. At the G7 summit in Germany, the U.S. president was asked for his reaction to the FIFA bribery and corruption scandal.
In conversations I've had here in Europe, people think it is very important for FIFA to be able to operate with integrity and transparency and accountability. And so as the investigation and charges proceed, I think we have to keep in mind that although football, soccer, depending on which side of the Atlantic you live on, is a game, it's also a massive business. It is a source of incredible national pride, and people want to make sure that it operates with integrity. The United States, by the way, since we keep on getting better and better at each World Cup, you know, we want to make sure that a sport that's gaining popularity is conducted in an upright manner.
U.S. President Barack Obama speaking at the G7 summit in Germany. Meanwhile, FIFA says it's suspended the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup because of the ongoing corruption scandal involving world football's governing body. At a news conference in Russia Wednesday, FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valka said, and I quote, "It would be nonsense to start any bidding process for the time being." The host of the 2026 World Cup was set to be chosen by FIFA members during a 2017 meeting in Malaysia. It's not clear now when the decision will be made. The United States, Canada, Mexico, and some European countries are expected to be among the likely bidders for the tournament. A U.S. indictment issued last month charges 9 FIFA officials and 5 corporate executives with offenses that include racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. A separate Swiss investigation is looking into allegations of mismanagement and money laundering connected to the awarding of the 2018 and 2022 World Cups to Russia and Qatar. Although he's not been formally charged with any crimes, FIFA President Sepp Blatter became caught up in the scandal and announced he would resign once a new president is elected sometime between December 2015 and March 2016. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the third part of a series on Johannesburg. And next, U.S.-Zimbabwe relations. But first, some music. Here is Warda of Algeria with Amal.
حياتي ملل نفس الحجايا ماتي ملل محتاجة لشيء جديد ياخدني بعيد بعيد ملل أمل وهو لسه باقي عندي أمل رغم اللي جرالي واللي حصل
بكرة حيكون سعيد وحنبدأ من جديد أملنا
يا حبيبي على دنيا حب حلوة
أنا عايزك النهاردة مش عايزة استنى بكرة
خدني يا حبيبي للعرش التنبيه
ما يقولش العمر عدى والحاضر يبقى ذكرى
خدني يا حبيبي على دنيا حب حلوة
أنا عايزك النهاردة
Word of Algeria with Amal.
Well, there's a home in the Johannesburg suburb of Auckland Park that's stuck in a time warp. To visit Linfield House is to experience a day in the life of an upper-class Victorian South African family. The Victorian era of British history was the period of Queen Victoria's reign from 1837 until her death in 1901. South Africa was a British colony at the time. Linfield House is filled with Victorian valuables. In the third part of a series on reminders of Johannesburg's past, Darren Taylor reports that the house is the most potent remnant of Victorian times in the city.
This is the drawing room, very full and cluttered. They thought it was in very bad taste to see an empty space anywhere.
Catherine Love is slight and pale, the refined and reserved owner of Linfield House. Its drawing room overflows with patterned wooden chairs, thick carpets, massive mirrors rimmed with gold, sparkling silver cutlery and polished ebony tables. This is where the Victorian owners would entertain guests. It's very dark inside the house. Love says this was typical of Victorian homes.
They not only like dark coloured wallpaper and paint, they purposely tried to shut out as much sunlight as possible so that it wouldn't fade their carpets and curtains and upholstery, so Victorian homes could be dark and gloomy.
Inside the 22-room mansion, Love tries her best to live just like a Victorian woman.
And I don't have a modern flat in the back. I use every room in the house. It's a great privilege to be able to live in a museum.
Linfield House was built in 1910. Love and her mother moved here in 1967 and began filling it with Victorian artefacts.
These are the cups that would be suitable for an at-home tea. Nice shallow cups.
The floral cups are incredibly dainty and stamped with gold. Upper-class Victorians used silver forks, bone-handled knives and china plates to eat fantastically well, platters of meat, pastries and puddings.
If it was just a family meal, there might only be four or five courses for dinner. If you had guests coming, there might be 10 or 12.
In true Victorian style, at mealtimes there were different rules for women.
Ladies were supposed to eat like birds. A well-bred lady had a very small appetite, so they would just pick at their food and send back the plates practically untouched.
One of the Victorians' many rules was to keep conversation at the dinner table light and frivolous.
You never spoke about anything controversial that might start an argument. No talking about religion or politics or anything like that. A lady should never bore a gentleman by talking about her embroidery or her children or the problems she was having with her servants. And gentlemen should not bore ladies by talking about their business. So,
Love says certain acts committed during a visit to a Victorian home were guaranteed to get a person shunned from high society.
Looking around the room as if you were assessing the people's wealth or making any comments about their furnishings or even saying that the food was delicious, because that implies that you are surprised. You should take it for granted that these people would have nothing but the best, so it's very bad manners to remark on it.
The Victorians have a reputation for impeccable manners, but Love says this wasn't always the case. She points to a big ivory-coloured pot under the dinner table.
Most toilets were outside in those days or far away from the dining room, so the men didn't see why they should have to go out into the cold or miss any of the conversation in the dining room. So they thought nothing of using it right here.
If the Victorians needed something from the kitchen, they simply rang a bell to summon a servant to deliver it to them. Love smirks and says they also had other sources of entertainment.
They would have played records. in the library where we are, there's this big collection of gramophone records.
Ladies were expected to excel at needlework, and everybody read a lot. The library shelves are packed with hundreds of leather-bound Victorian period books.
There are musical instruments throughout the house. It was everybody's duty to be able to play a musical instrument.
The music room contains a variety of musical instruments, including an antique piano and a mandolin guitar made in 1894. It looks more like a harp. Lindfield House hasn't escaped Johannesburg's crime wave. Love says armed robbers have targeted it twice.
On one occasion, they tied me up and locked me in the wardrobe, but they kept asking me, where's the cell phone, where's the microwave, where's the TV? They couldn't find anything worth stealing. Eventually, they took a top hat and a few Victorian coins and left.
What do you think they did with the top hat?
Perhaps one of them just wanted to wear it.
Disguise for his escape?
Yes, probably. He jumped over the gate wearing the top hat and nearly knocked over a passerby on the pavement.
As Love leads the way into yet another relic of a room, she says Lindfield House has extreme historical significance, not just for South Africa, but for the world. But it's a legacy under threat. Love knows she won't be around forever to maintain the museum. And so far, she hasn't been able to find a heritage organization that's willing to do so when she's gone. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The U.S. Congress has raised concern and skepticism over future relations with Zimbabwe. This was revealed at a recent hearing in Washington. Reporter Indimia Kimoakalielie has more.
In their quest to find out what is really happening in Zimbabwe, members of Congress had a barrage of questions for witnesses. Shannon Smith of the State Department, former Zimbabwean white commercial farmer Ben Frith, and Imani Countess of the Solidarity Center. Congressman Christopher Smith, the chair of the subcommittee on Africa that sponsored the hearing titled The Future of U.S.-Zimbabwe Relations, raised concern over continued reports of human rights violations by the government and President Robert Mugabe's ability to lead the country.
If the government's repressive tactics are not troubling enough, political jockeying in Zimbabwe, including the dismissal of Vice President Joyce Mujuru, places the succession to President Mugabe in doubt, which puts U.S. policy in question.
Responding to the questions on sanctions, Shannon Smith of the State Department reiterated the position that sanctions were targeted.
We have sanctions on approximately 106 individuals and 70 entities, and they are intended to be targeted. They are aimed at individuals who have disrupted democracy, engaged in corruption and other acts. The Department of Treasury, the OFAC office, evaluates those situations. But more fundamentally, it remains the sort of strongest statement, I think, of American values. Does the Zimbabwe government continue to blame their woes on it? Absolutely.
The members of Congress pressed witnesses on the state of the opposition, which the U.S. had once supported and counted on as the alternative government to that of President Mugabe.
It's a matter of sort of fact and record now that the opposition has been splintering, that the movement for democratic change now has multiple movements for democratic change within it under separate leadership. There is no sort of unifying message at the moment that stretches across these parties.
With the opposition weakened and alternatives to the current government lacking, in light of those reports and the deteriorating situation in Zimbabwe, Congressman Kurt Clawson questioned the reason for supporting Zimbabwe in areas outside humanitarian issues, saying that other efforts were, in his words, hopeless. Countess, whose organization champions the right of workers, stressed the importance of staying engaged in Zimbabwe for the security of neighboring countries.
Zimbabwe is in the middle of southern Africa. What do you think will happen in South Africa, Botswana, Mozambique, Namibia, if that country implodes?
Responding to this, Clawson rebuked regional leaders who he says have continued to prop up President Mugabe despite the wave of refugees fleeing their countries due to the hardships in Zimbabwe.
So realistically, what do we do? I mean, I'm all for humanitarian
help. But these same countries that you said will be impacted by the implosion are sitting it out while white people, black people, women, men, poor, everybody gets hurt by this guy.
Ben Frith, a former farmer in Zimbabwe whose father-in-law died as a result of the land raids, called on the members of Congress to maintain pressure on President Mugabe to adhere to the rule of law, particularly for the country's remaining white population, who he says have been segregated and victimized.
What I was asking the United States to do today, in the spirit of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, is to say that racism is wrong.
Journalism professor Stanford Mukasa lauded the congressional members for holding the hearing on Zimbabwe.
The United States has made it clear that it will not engage Zimbabwe in a positive way in as far as supporting its political process until and unless democracy, rule of law are all respected. And Itai Dzamara has now become a kind of an icon in terms of what must be done in Zimbabwe today.
The congressional hearing ended without any indications of dramatic change in relations between the two nations in the near future, with the U.S. expected to maintain its position of targeted sanctions on President Mugabe and his inner circle. Reporting from Washington, this is Ndimyake Mwakalielie.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Though it faces a food security crisis that threatens more than 4 million of its people, the government of South Sudan took the extraordinary and regrettable step of expelling the top United Nations official working there to help address the emergency. The government of South Sudan indicated that the decision to expel UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer came after remarks Lanzer made in a television interview regarding the gravity of the humanitarian crisis facing the country. The humanitarian crisis is the direct result of ongoing fighting between the government and opposition forces that began in December 2013, when a political split between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar erupted into violence. The United States condemns the decision to expel Mr. Lanzer. The action is an affront to the international community working to bring peace and stability to South Sudan. It also demonstrates a callous disregard for the suffering of the South Sudanese people. The government's priority should be bringing an end to the violence that has already displaced more than 2 million of its citizens, half a million of whom are now refugees in neighboring countries, and left 4.6 million facing extreme, life-threatening hunger. The United States has contributed more than $1.1 billion in emergency aid to house, feed, and provide medical services for the people of South Sudan, as well as improve water, sanitation, and hygiene services. We strongly support the work of the UN mission in South Sudan and that of Mr. Lanzer, who has been instrumental in addressing the dire humanitarian needs of conflict-affected communities and has been a strong partner and advocate for vulnerable populations in South Sudan. We join UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other governments in calling on the government of South Sudan to reverse its decision and to cooperate fully with all United Nations entities present in South Sudan, as well as other international organizations working on behalf of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.